Come on aboard, I promise you. There's lots of room for you on the bandwagon.
Hey there, welcome into another episode of the Bandwagon Sports Podcast. I'm Brian Moline.
I'm Lisa Braltz.
John Steinbacher.
Next time I'm going to be last so I can do something fun with my name. I forgot. We're supposed to do that this time.
Anyway. We are back. It is another fun episode of the Bandwagon here this week. A lot of great things coming up. Our special guest will be Illinois soccer coach Janet Rayfield. You don't want to miss that. We'll talk a little bit about the Lovey Love here in Champaign-Urbana, that era getting started here this weekend. And we've got our usual social media nonsense coming up as well, plus a nice American League baseball rivalry to talk about. Hey, and it's not Yankees-Red Sox, so that's fun. All that coming up here on the Bandwagon. But first, a little Olympic talk just to kind of put a bow on things here.
Right. Well, a bow, really. I don't know. What I'm talking about is not a bow. I'm sort of a downer today. I'm feeling like sort of the downer person today. The only wrap-up bit that I wanted to mention, and you guys can jump in however you like, is that, you know, the Olympics are over, everything has happened, the closing ceremonies have happened, and immediately NBC weighs in, and they're like, it cost $12 billion, it was a bust, and it's all the fault of...
Millennials.
Yeah, they get blamed for everything, and they've been blamed for this. And I have many, many threads on Reddit where there has been exhaustive discussion. I will say that one of the funniest things that I saw was actually on social media, where a guy who is decidedly not a millennial. Okay, this is a gentleman who's probably well into his 50s. The older I get, I want to bump him into the 60s. He says, the worst thing about being on the West Coast, waiting 3 hours to see spectacular men swim relay and having to avoid Twitter at all to ensure suspense. And the executive producer of the Olympics from NBC, Jim Bell, says, then stream it live. Guys, and he gets the reply back from the gentleman in a bar without laptop. And the producer says, then move back east. And then somebody else jumps in and says, how about you stream it live real time everywhere and none of this delay nonsense? It's 2016, not 1992. Boom. And I will say, that is largely the feeling of people in these Reddit threads and in other discussions that I've been a part of and that I've read online, is that the rest, broadcast TV has to catch up with the habits of everyone. And people are cutting cords and they want to watch in a lot of different ways. And I think broadcast was kind of caught with their pants down.
You know, that's why I kind of thought that really the best coverage NBC did a lot of the times was on the weekends, because they could just carry live whatever was happening on Saturday and Sunday. They didn't have to worry about broadcast schedules. They just carried what was happening. So like on a Saturday, I'd flip it on and I'd have it on for 3 or 4 hours. You know, I might go out of the room and do something and come back. And but I thought some of the best coverage NBC did was just during the day on the weekend, because they could show what was happening and they weren't trying to shoehorn it all into prime time.
Well, and I think they've been working they've been doing the Olympics for like 30 or 40 years now, almost exclusively. And, you know, they've built this. The Olympics aren't sports. It's a narrative story that Bob Costas has to sit in front of a fireplace and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I read some things that were pretty, quite honestly disrespectful to women, about how women don't want to watch sports. They want to watch, a story, which, you know, I think not only has NBC not caught up with how people watch, but they haven't caught up with why people watch. And, you know, I'm sure 30 years ago there were a lot more women who were more interested in the story, just like there were probably a lot more men. But women are, you know, they're great sports fans now. They want to see sports. They don't want to necessarily see whatever.
Well, and also, like, I really enjoyed the streams where there was no commentary, where it was just like gymnastics or swimming or track events, where there was nobody talking, nobody telling me what to think, nobody telling me what was going on, nobody dumbing it down for me. So that's the other thing I think that has changed, is that people do have so many options now that a lot of sports fans, or just people who hate the talking heads all the time, are going to choose an option that is just the event itself and doesn't have, you know, you just have crowd noise and that's it. And I found that incredibly compelling and I loved it.
So the Olympics are done, and thanks, millennials, for killing NBC's ratings.
Yeah, so lots of links in the show notes for this. So we're not going to take up a lot of time talking about it, but
right.
Yeah.
What are the NBC going to do without that big Coca-Cola money?
Yeah, that's a good question. Now we're on to another great event down in Rio, the Paralympics, which I think folks here in Champaign-Urbana probably pay more attention to the Paralympics than a lot of markets do, just because the University of Illinois has been so active in their wheelchair athletics program. So there's certainly a lot of great University of Illinois athletes taking part in the Paralympics. And there's been, there was a lot of coverage like right as the Olympics were ending that the Paralympics could be in trouble, could be in danger of having a lot of things cut and everything else. And now we're kind of in this dead zone of coverage about it where we're not really hearing
we're in the algae pool
and it doesn't start till September 7th, so there's still about a week away or so. But I think what happened was there were a lot of reporters down there. This story kind of came up and they were filing them, and then we predicted what would happen. Nobody cares about Rio anymore. The only thing we really care about Rio now is what's going to happen with Ryan Lochte. I did read somewhat more recent article in some UK. So the
was
UK
it the Guardian?
The Telegraph.
Oh, okay.
But also the BBC. But the UK seems to be keeping up with the story a little bit more than anywhere else. And the controversy seems to be, so apparently there's just one big pool of money that the Rio Olympics have that's supposed to go to both. And the controversy seems to be they spent more than they said they were going to on the regular Olympics. So there's less left for the Paralympics. There was talk about how tickets aren't selling, but I think it's still pretty early. We'll have to see how it goes. Obviously, I just watched some video of some Paralympic events, and it's pretty awesome. Table tennis, which I know is a favorite of Lisa, has some spectacular stuff. So, I mean, I'm sure it's not covered in the same way, but it's probably well worth watching. And as you mentioned, one of the greatest athletes in the world, and definitely the greatest Paralympic athlete, Tatiana McFadden, local.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
Oh, and actually, we should link to this. She was just on Real Sports on HBO.
Sweet.
Yeah, so.
Well, and that's the other thing. Like, if you watched any television at all or were anywhere online at all, you had the Olympics, big Olympics, shoved down your throat, the coverage. You knew it was NBC. Whereas Paralympics, it's like, well, where do we find that? Like, where am I going to go to find that? I mean,
I think it will all be streaming. I saw that.
Yes, so. Which is great. I'm just saying that that's another thing that just sort of everybody's like, oh, the Paralympics are in trouble, but like no other information about how you can watch if, when they're on or whatever.
Exactly.
So it's like, I'm sure I would love to watch the table tennis, and I think the wheelchair racing, the long distance wheelchair stuff is amazeballs.
And they play soccer blindfolded, because it's with impaired vision, so sort of equal the playing field. Everyone has blindfolds. If you have any kind of vision, it's amazing to watch.
Yep. I'm so there. I have to watch that. I bet that's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Paralympics will get started, as John said, on September 7th. So we'll certainly have a little follow-up there and see how all of the U of I and local athletes do in the Paralympics. Pleased to welcome into the studio for our guest segment this week, Janet Rayfield, Illinois soccer coach. Janet and I spent a lot of time together in my previous life doing play-by-play, among other things, for Illinois soccer. So, Janet, it's great to reconnect with you here today.
Great to be here, Brian. Great to talk Illinois soccer with you once again.
Yeah, definitely. Season started here a couple of weeks ago for you. You got started with a really nice exhibition win over Notre Dame, a couple of wins at home, and then some challenges on your road trip here the last week. So you're standing at 2-2. How would you evaluate where the team is so far this year?
Well, this early in the season, it's tough to go on the road and get two losses. But I don't think in my 25-year career I've lost two games back-to-back on penalty kicks. So, that makes it a little bit of a challenge, and we've got to take it for what it's worth from that standpoint. I thought we played well and handled a really athletic, fast-paced Missouri team, got two goals, which I think has been, you know, kind of an issue for us. But, you know, gave up a corner kick goal, gave up a penalty kick goal, and we've given up one goal in the run of play. So, you know, I think in terms of us putting our defense together, we feel pretty good about that. We've just got to, you know, stop making mistakes in the box and adjust to referees and some of those sorts of things. But I really do feel like things are coming together for us. It's a blend of seniors, and we've got some freshmen in the mix that are really making an impact. And, you know, we got to gel a little bit more in terms of goal scoring. But we're pretty pleased with where things are, I think, so far.
Sure. And in terms of goal scoring, I think the name that most people will remember from the last few years for you is Janelle Flaws. She's gone off and is playing professionally now. But who's kind of trying to step up and maybe replace some of that goal scoring for you?
Yeah, you know, I think Carr Marbury and Patricia George are, you know, names that come, you know, up right away. And Patricia scored, you know, I think her first collegiate goal, but a great goal. And you can just see from that goal against Missouri kind of what possibilities are there. You know, great strike from probably 20 yards out. Carr made a great run to clear some space for her. So, you know, those two, I think, are starting to get a little bit of a relationship. And then you got freshman Kelly Mayday coming in off the bench, who in the SLU game had two great opportunities late. And again, as a freshman, just to get in and get those kind of opportunities, I think, is great. And then you got Reagan Robichaud, who's coming back now off her ACL. I don't think is quite where she was before that, but is, I think, getting better and better every day. So I think you'll start to see her make an impact as well.
Another road swing for you this week, heading down to your neck of the woods originally, the Texas area. So you'll play TCU and Texas A&M. Tell us a little bit about those matchups.
Yeah, you know, two great games. TCU is undefeated right now. They went on the road and beat Maryland in their first game. And then we're on the road. They've been on the road for three straight games now. So we'll be their home opener. So, you know, there'll be some excitement, and they're really going to want to continue that undefeated streak at home. So, you know, that's going to be important. It's going to be fun. It's, you know, Coach Bell, who was an assistant coach here for a while, who's leading the TCU squad. And I think there's at least 20 Rayfield family members scheduled to be in attendance. So, and you know, it's Claire Wheatley's home area as well. So, you know, I think there'll be some Illini fans. I think it'll be a great matchup, and certainly a TCU team that's on fire right now.
So I have a question. You mentioned that your team has lost two games in a row on penalty kicks. What do you think about penalty kicks? All summer long, we've been watching soccer and games that would go all the way to PKs, Olympics, the Euro, are decided on penalty kicks. And a lot of non-coaching, maybe like laypersons I talk to, say they would love to get rid of penalty kicks. It seems like a terrible way to lose a game or to win a game. I guess winning a game is probably great no matter how you win it, right? So, but so what do you think of that? I'm curious. Like, that had to have sucked.
I think, you know, especially I think the Missouri game where it's, you know, sudden victory and the PK gets called a little bit, you know, certainly had time in the SLU game to come back from a penalty kick in the fourth minute. But, you know, if you think about just penalty kicks in general and games ending, you know, after overtime, I've been around the game long enough. I'm about to date myself. When in the NCAA, they wouldn't go to penalty kicks. They would just continue 10-minute sudden victory overtimes until someone won. And I can remember watching it. Indiana Duke men's game, that the game probably lasted 4 hours. I think there was 10 overtimes. They played more minutes of overtime than they did of regulation. And you've got players, I mean, just dangerous. I think with the difficulty scoring, the alternative to penalty kicks may not be as there's some unintended consequences to say we're not going to go to PKs. You know, I think it's the nature of the game. And, you know, it's a difficult way to win or lose a game. But I think anytime you've got a tied match, you know, 15-point set in volleyball is a tough way to go.
Right.
That's a quick game. And, you know, one little change, one service error can cost you. So I think that's the nature of sports. I told our team, after these two games, you just don't want to put yourself in position to let that happen. You know, we've got to create more chances to score goals. We've got to score more goals, and then we're not in a position for something like that to affect the outcome.
Well, it's certainly been a little bit of a time of transition in the athletic department. I think John wanted to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I was just curious. Obviously, as you mentioned, you know, athletics is a business, so to speak, and changes happen, but you know, what's it like sort of midstream and like somewhat unexpectedly to have your boss, the athletic director, replaced, and what's it like working with Josh Whitman?
Yeah, you know, I think I've been really fortunate in my 25 years of coaching. Josh will be my fourth AD. I've had friends and colleagues who have had four in less than 4 years. So I think I've been pretty fortunate to have a consistent AD for a long time at Arkansas, and certainly Ron Gunther here for probably 10 years during my coaching career. But, you know, I think this transition has been super positive in the athletic department. Everywhere I go, people seem to be smiling about things that are happening here. And when you talk about it, college athletics right now is a business, and it is a big business, and it's big money, and there's lots of things to take into account. And I think what I really like about Josh is he is a brilliant businessman. I think you can see that. He's bright. He's, very thoughtful in terms of how he's put people in the athletic department, some of the structural changes he's made, people he's put in places. I'm really, I guess I would say, in agreement. I think he's put people in really great places that's going to put them in position to be successful, and I'm excited about what that future holds for Illinois athletics.
And so, and that makes me curious, too, about how the mood in your part of campus is really positive, and people are smiling, happy, excited. There's a lot of change, good things going on. The rest of the campus, you know, where we all get these letters like the budget impasse, and, you know, it's not all total doom and gloom, but I have to wonder if any of those missives affect how you guys are doing business or how you approach your day. Like, there's this sort of, I don't want to call it a divide. It's not a divide between, like, the academic side of campus and the sports side of campus, but it's more like, I feel like it has to affect some of the things that you do in terms of being able to recruit coaches, for example, and bring people here. If they do any research about the state, they know that, like, things are sort of kind of crazy here sometimes.
Yeah, and I think that's a challenge that we all face on this campus, athletic department included. I think with college athletics and the money and the finances there, I think it's a really difficult – I think Josh himself is in a really difficult position when you've got a campus that has financial issues that impact us, but yet the things like the Big Ten Network and things are good financial situations for the athletic department. But you're also very thoughtful of what that means to people that are up here on campus. And, you know, I think everybody in this state, everybody in the city of Chicago and here and all the other college campuses have to be aware of, you know, kind of where things are within the state and the state budget. But I don't think that takes away from the academic reputation that this school has. And, you know, I've talked to several professors, and irrespective of the financial side of things, what's going on this campus, the College of Medicine, and, you know, we just hired a great dean of that college from Wake Forest, another great institution. So, you know, I think even from a recruiting standpoint, what the strengths of this school haven't gone away because of some financial issues within the state. The academics, I don't think, have suffered. Our rankings haven't suffered in the world of academics, and that's what, you know, academics and athletics are what attract our student athletes to this campus, and to me that hasn't changed.
And with sort of the hiring of Josh, obviously there's a big impact came with the hiring of Lovie Smith, just sort of like a new superstar on campus. Has that had any impact on you, or is it just sort of a nice thing to happen down the street?
I think anytime there's something positive going on with the athletic department, it affects us all. If a volleyball wins, there's an excitement there.
Sure.
When we win games, it was great to get the first win of the, you know, Illinois college season. There's a lot of pressure when you're the first game. You know, you don't want to start the season off that way. So I think anytime there's positive things going on, it affects us all. And certainly Lovie's hiring was a huge positive. You know, I think he's got great ideas and great thoughts and wants this program to be successful. I've had several interactions with him. All have been positive. He's super supportive of the rest of the college athletics here on campus. He's been very responsive in terms of, you know, meeting with some of our alumni that have come back, certainly willing to meet with recruits and stuff. So I think he's on board to help Illinois athletics, not just to help Illinois football. And I think that's fantastic for all of us. You know, but we all know it's, you know, football's got to...
Right.
But he himself said, I'm not here as a savior. I'm here as a coach to try to help turn things around. And, you know, we've got to give him time to do his thing. It's one coach isn't going to change this program. I think he can change a lot of things about it and get things moving in the right direction. And certainly we're all excited about that.
It's like that rising tide lifting all boats kind of thing.
Absolutely.
If the tide rises, we'll see, right? This weekend, they've got that game coming up. So.
Yeah, and we can't expect the tide to go all at once. You know,
I
think it's going to rise, and then, you know, it will rise again a little bit higher. And, you know, I think it was Northwestern football coach that said, what you don't see is how much is going on before you actually get to that point. You know, it's going to be small steps and steps that a lot of people don't see before we make that big jump into being a national powerhouse football team. But we've got to see the little things along the way. And I think that's something that Levy's working on right now are some of those little things that a couple years down the road are going to make a huge difference. And certainly from a recruiting standpoint, I think I saw a post the other day. We've got, you know, more NFL experience on this football staff than any college football staff around. And, you know, if I'm a young high school football player, that's exciting to me, especially if I have aspirations to play in the NFL.
Absolutely. So along similar lines, but we'll move back to soccer here and talk more talk about development of players. I am a mom, and I had a soccer player from the age of 4 until she finished out her senior year this last year at 17. I'm curious to know your thoughts about the development of youth soccer in this country and where it's been and where it's going. And Brian and I had talked a little bit, and John and I, we've talked a little bit about there's the difference between the development of youth soccer in the United States and in other countries. And then there's the difference in development between men's and women's soccer in this country, too. Women's soccer seems to be so much further ahead, probably because of the success of the U.S. women's national team. MLS is coming up, though, too. There's more and more support for that. So I guess my first question is about the development of soccer in the United States, both boys and girls, youth soccer, and your feelings about that, especially as, like, my husband is a park district coach in Urbana, and he's seen more and more kids funneled away either to other sports, like he coaches girls. Girls are playing softball or running track, or they are moving to club soccer, which there's an economic barrier there for a lot of young people. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I think the and I'll say problem, because I do think that that's, we can identify what it is. I don't think it's unique to soccer. I think it's youth sports. It's hard to separate soccer from youth sports if you talk about development, because you know, a young child at the age of 7 or 8 shouldn't get pulled away from soccer for another sport. They should be able to participate in all of those sports. Who knows what a 7-year-old is really going to be passionate about? You know, for me, I didn't start soccer till I was 12. I think I knew at that point, you know, I had played a lot of other sports, and it didn't take me long to figure out, one, that that's probably where my talent lie. But it was also just something I became passionate about right from the get-go. But I was 12, and so I think I could understand that. And now I think youth sports has gotten to where we start specializing a little bit early, and then you have club sports, and there's this economic part to that. There's a lot of people making money off youth sports, and so they want those youth sports in their programs. And I think that's caused some real issues, some economic barriers for people to participate in sports, and also some specialization that's happening way too early. And I think we see that with our college athletes and some of the, I won't say injuries, but some of the physiological issues that we deal with because they've specialized in a single sport for so long, you know, overuse kinds of things and imbalances. Soccer is a pretty quad dominant, not very flexible oriented sport. So you play that for a long time, and there's just issues that you get to when you start to try to play at this higher level. So I think all of those things, and I think we've got to look at what youth sports is doing in terms of developing people, in terms of developing even just the athletic side of things. So there are certainly some issues with respect to that. The good thing is, especially on the women's side of things, that there's so many more programs now for female athletes. And I think that's why you see the women's soccer being so successful. Women athletes were – it was accepted to start to develop young female athletes in this country way before it was in other countries. So it was our development of female athletes that put us ahead in the world of soccer. Other countries are catching up now because they have a soccer culture that we don't have. And the soccer culture is what put our men's program behind, or the lack of soccer culture. So our soccer culture is growing, and other countries are catching up with respect to letting women really participate in athletics.
So in Europe, for women, for young women, do they have like the club systems that they have for men over there. Like Real Madrid can have an academy that you can a kid will go to when they're 7 years old, and Real Madrid basically pays for you to go through that whole system until they decide you are either good enough or not good enough to keep going, right? So do they have anything like that for girls?
It's starting, and probably more so, I would say, in Germany and England. I think those are two of the countries that have really kind of jumped on board in terms of women. You're seeing Sweden, obviously. You saw them in the Olympics. So you're seeing it happen more and more, and it's happening I would say similar to here in the U.S. You look at the men's EPL, and a lot of those programs now have women's teams, not near to the depth and not near to the youth development programs that are available for men in those countries. You know, we're catching up on probably what's been 70, 80 years of programs that now have been maybe 10 to 15 years of programs for the women. So they're certainly behind, but they're starting to move in that direction and starting to offer youth development programs for girls in those countries. And that's why you see them catching up and being as being, you know, more competitive with the United States.
I have one more question just about the women that you've coached. And off mic, just before we started, we were talking about like how a lot of them have moved on with their lives and they're maybe not necessarily playing professional soccer, although you've coached a few players who have moved in that direction. Do you find that the players that you've coached are still really like hyper interested in the sport? Do they want to coach if they're not continuing to play? Are they, if they are having kids, are they encouraging their kids in that direction? Do they really... You know, they're going to be parents in a completely different type of youth athletic system and soccer, developing soccer culture than what they grew up in or where they were coached. What are you seeing happen?
Yeah. You know, that's the fun part, I think, of being a coach here for so long is you've got, you know, former student athletes. They're in every walk of life now, from professional soccer to orthopedic surgeon to lawyers to, you know, I tell people I'm set for life based on the careers of all my former athletes. But I think that's what's changing in the culture across the United States and certainly with my former athletes is now you have parents who were very involved in soccer and understand the sport and appreciate the sport and are fans of the sport. And you see them taking their young children to games and getting them involved and being involved with them. You know, my father helped coach soccer when I was growing up and didn't have a clue about the sport. He still doesn't. He's got a bit better clue now, but it's just there's a different culture now in terms of that. You know, I've got some former athletes who are coaching in different venues, whether it be, you know, helping out at their high school or, you know, coaching in their kids' environments and those sorts of things. But they're soccer fans. They follow the sport. They follow Illinois soccer, but they just follow soccer in general. They follow the Chicago Red Stars because there's a former alumni. They follow Ella and her treks in Sweden, but they just follow the sport. They're fans. Some of them are huge EPL fans. Some of them have their favorite team. So it's the soccer community in the United States is growing because, you know, whether it's my nieces and nephews or my former athletes, they grew up with the sport. And so now they're fans of it. It's not just baseball and football and those sorts of sports now that they're fans of.
Well, Janet, before we let you go, you mentioned two road matches for you this week. Back home next week, I believe. So when can we come out and see the Illini again?
Yeah, Friday, Sunday, next weekend. Friday at 7, Sunday at 1 again. Our last two non-conference games before we start conference play at home the following weekend. So, you know, we're excited. It's these two road trips have been really good tests for us, and certainly this weekend will be a great test. And then, you know, we want to come home and finish the non-conference season off, with a bang, so to speak. And really, it's a great product. So we've had some great fan support already. We have over 1,000 fans at our home opener, which has been a
awesome.
Great start for us. I think it's Illinois Football Club night on Friday night. So I think you'll see a lot of the youth soccer players coming out to the game. September is Youth Soccer Month. So I think it's time for, you know, really exciting time for youth soccer in this community and around. And hopefully we'll have a great crowd out there next weekend.
All right. So it's Miami of Ohio, I believe, next Friday and Evansville next Sunday.
That's correct.
I'll be hurling friendly abuse at the referees. That's my job. That's what I do when I come out. So friendly.
Well, based on the last couple of weeks, you'll have plenty of fodder for that.
Well, so one of my friends, Ed Schell, was a ref here in town for a long time, and he worked for the U of I, so he couldn't do any of the like Big Ten or conference games, but he was always my favorite target. So I'm sort of sad he's gone. I'm going to have to find a new target.
I think there's plenty out there.
Yes. I'm on it.
Illinois
thanks,
soccer
Lisa.
Coach Janet Rayfield, thanks so much for coming out and joining us on the bandwagon today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
thanks again to Janet Rayfield for stopping by. And
she is the bomb.
She absolutely is the bomb.
She's the business.
I've known her for about 10 years now, and always great to catch up with the coach. And speaking of coaches, Janet mentioned Lovie Smith is also starting his first year now on the University of Illinois campus, and certainly we're kind of in that honeymoon period for Lovie right now.
It's a lot of excitement. He recently landed a couple big recruits from Missouri. Hasn't happened in a while, so that was exciting. For a while there, we were worried about his recruiting prowess, although I think he's been on the job for, 5 months, so give him a little more time. But, yeah, Murray State this weekend should be an easy win. If they don't win this game, the pitchforks will come out very fast. But it'll be interesting to see how the season goes, what the narrative is going to be. I think he'll have more time. I think he'll have more than a year, but
he will. He will.
Well, that was something I didn't want to bring up with Coach Rayfield. It was like, you know, she's like, the rising tide's going to take a while. It's not going to come in all at once. I'm like, tell the fandom that, because, you know, immediately, you know, if we don't win by 50 points, you know, it's not just talk radio anymore. It's podcasts. It's Twitter. It's everybody. Blah blah.
As a call-in show veteran, I can tell you, it does not take long for the complaints to start coming if there's if there's a loss. But I do think that the fans understand. I mean, there was a reason that a change was made. It really wasn't anything that Bill Cubitt did wrong. It was kind of the remnants of Tim Beckman and the damage caused to the program from all that.
And I do think the new AD really does seem to be steady as she goes. Like he's got a vision and a plan. And it just feels to me more like the whole program is in really good hands. And so the fans are going to want what they want. But I think all he has to do is, like, glare at them. Didn't he play football? He was a football player here, right?
He was.
He's just got to stare them down a little bit and be like, you know, handle it, dudes. And then I think it will be fine.
Yeah. A friend of the bandwagon, Will Leach, had a really good article on the beginning of the Lovie Smith era up this week, just talking about how...
We'll link to that.
Yeah, I think the headline had something to do with the quest for normalcy for Illinois football.
Yeah, right.
Basically, the expectations of Illinois fandom for football are basically, all right, don't embarrass us and be a competitive program.
Right.
That's the expectations for Illinois
Maybe
football.
Sneak in a Big Ten championship every 10, 15 years.
Yeah, be competitive. Go to a bowl game most of the time. Win 6, 7, 8 games on average. And then pop up and have a really good season once in a while.
An Iowa.
Yeah.
A Wisconsin.
Yeah.
For football. It's totally different for basketball.
Oh, yeah.
I think it'll be interesting to see. Obviously, Lovie Smith runs a very different type of team, especially on offense, than Bill Cubitt. So it'll take him a couple years to install that. But what do you think? 6 wins in a bowl? Is that a success?
It's realistic.
Okay.
I think that's realistic. Talking to the News Gazette's Lauren Tate Sunday night during our TV pledge coverage.
Right.
John was a part of that as well.
WILLpledge.org if you're interested.
Yeah, absolutely. we talked about that with Lauren while we had a couple of Illinois football documentaries on. We talked quite a bit about this year's team. And, you know, and he knows as much about it as almost anybody does. And I kind of wrapped up by asking him, okay, what are realistic expectations for this season? And he said, I think fans could realistically expect a 6-6 record and going to a bowl game this year. The caveat to that is it's not a deep team. So if you have injuries at the wrong spot, quarterback probably being one of them, a couple spots on defense are pretty thin. If there's some injuries, it could fall apart a little bit on them this year. But, you know, overall, 6-6.
And they're very familiar with that across the street.
Oh, yes. Yes.
At the Assembly State Farm Center.
Yeah, that's what we saw last year there. So the Lovie era begins this Saturday, 2:30 kickoff against the Murray State Racers.
There's a red moon rising on the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland to the lake. There's a red moon rising on the Cuyahoga River.
All right, now it's rivalry time. And this week, it was my duty to choose one, and I have to confess I was a little bit derelict in my rivalry choosing duties. It did not happen until this morning when I was prompted by my co-host John Steinbacher. But I think I came up with a pretty good under the radar rivalry for you this week. The Cleveland Indians are in first place in the American League Central. That doesn't happen all that often for Cleveland. But they're ahead by a few games over their rival, the Detroit Tigers. And it's a rivalry that kind of goes under the radar unless you kind of live in that Great Lakes area, I think. Because I remember this was about 15 years ago. My wife and I went to a game at Comerica Park. I think it was maybe open for its second year at the time. We were just kind of passing through on our way up into Canada and stopped and saw a game there. And they were playing Cleveland. And Detroit was not good that year. But Cleveland had a good team. They were kind of at the end of their glory run in the 1990s where they were winning division titles every year. And I noticed that Cleveland brought a ton of people to that game in Detroit. It was a pretty good crowd. I think it was a Saturday day game and probably about 35,000 people. And I'd bet almost half of them were from Cleveland that day. And it just kind of struck me that, you know, these two cities, they're similar in a lot of ways. You know, they were big manufacturing cities right after World War II. They both had their issues. But Detroit seems to have been able to sustain more success sports-wise. Not that they're powerhouses by any means, but they've had World Series titles. They've had NBA titles. Then there's the Lions, of course.
Well, the Red Wings.
Yeah, and the Red Wings were very good in the NHL, especially in the 90s, early 2000s. Then there's Cleveland that really just has had their sports issues, finally winning a title this year with the Cleveland Cavaliers. But this one just kind of struck me as kind of a nice under-the-radar rivalry here in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, and I don't really think about it, but it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, the Indians have been good around the same time as the Tigers, but I can't remember a year where they were going down to the wire. Maybe I'm just...
I can't really think of one off the top of my head either. It seems like, you know, Detroit popped up in the 80s and had some really good teams. They won the World Series in 84. Mm-hmm. At that time, Cleveland was not competitive at all. And then in the 90s, when Cleveland had their run, they made the World Series a couple of times. Detroit really was down. And then they kind of reversed roles again. So, yeah, this is the first time I can remember where those two teams are really fighting for a championship. One other note about this rivalry, it kind of spoke more to kind of Cleveland's curse that they were going through. But back in the 1950s, Cleveland had a really good home run hitting outfielder named Rocky Colavito, who was kind of a folk hero in Cleveland at the time. They traded him to Detroit for a slap-hitting guy named Harvey Keene, who had won a batting title. So, you know, back then that carried a lot of cachet,
sure.
Batting title. But at the time, Harvey was kind of on his way down. He'd already peaked. He'd already had his best years. So the newspapers in Cleveland just crucified. I believe it was Frank Lane was the general manager in Cleveland at the time. And so just that was kind of a marker of Detroit getting the best of Cleveland, which would be kind of a trend for the next 50 years or so.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how this one wraps up. It's good that there's not a lot of exciting races. Maybe for the wild card, but there's not a lot of exciting races around. So I think the AL East and the AL Central are the best ones, right?
Yeah, I think so. And the NL West with the Dodgers and Giants, that's a tight one as well.
I know nothing about this rivalry, so I've learned a lot by listening. And what is fascinating to me is the difference in the way rivalries plays out now versus the way they played out. Like, you know, there were probably like bar fights and stuff over rivalries, and maybe there still are, but now people like duke it out over Twitter,
yeah,
or you know, or start mean memes or something. And so it's interesting to me, but the feelings are still very powerful. So this is like giving me some ideas for future rivalries, because old school rivalries, and they can be like micro rivalries. They could be like an old high school rivalry or something. So I've got some ideas. So thank you for this. This is a good one.
I like the idea of two towns that have sort of run on hard times, but still, you know, the way sports kind of can still give you a sense of pride, even especially Detroit, but Cleveland. I know. A lot of people don't think so highly of Cleveland either. Not putting words in my mouth, but it's just interesting, like you mentioned, two sort of Rust Belt cities have fallen on hard times, still finding domestic, or not domestic, but
What's Sports weird? Bliss?
Yes.
There you go.
Good one.
So that's our rivalry this week, the Indians and the Tigers. So we'll have some great links to discuss that one for you up on our web post as well. And with that, it's time to segue into our social media nonsense this week. Who wants to go first?
I'll go first because it's really short. So this morning, I always say that. I always say it's really short and then it never is. John tagged me in a Facebook post this morning because of some mutual friends of ours. Somebody had posted a video from the BBC archive of a dour-looking Englishman wearing, like, his little pork pie hat. It's a black-and-white video from probably, I don't know, 60 years ago, maybe even more, playing ping pong with his cat.
Yes.
And the cat is brilliant.
Yeah?
The cat is absolutely brilliant. If I could have guarantees that my cats would do this, we would have a ping pong table in my house right now. But I think my cats would just sit there and be like, whatever.
Yeah, well, you told
they're
me.
They're too old now.
Yeah, I was going to say, your cats are at least 12 years old now.
Yeah, they're aging. They'd be mildly interested in the ball, but like.
They'd watch it.
They'd watch it and be like, whatever, you guys.
But like Janet said, though, if you started them too early, they might define their. They
could get some injuries or something.
Overuse injuries in the paw.
Yeah, exactly. Or like too much time on the hind legs might not be so good. So, but anyway, so thank you, John, for sending that. And I will definitely post a link to that video because it is charming as all get out.
Awesome. I'll go next, if you don't mind, John.
I would love for you to go next.
Well, mine is a two-parter. Last year, you might remember, if you're a Cubs fan in particular, there was a game fairly early in the season where the Cubs were playing Pittsburgh. And it was, I believe it was an extra innings, and Matt Caesar was the batter, and he just hit like this little harmless pop fly into shallow right field. And the Pittsburgh Pirates have a really good right fielder named Gregory Polanco. In fact, he's one of the best right fielders defensively in the game. And he came in to make the catch, and I don't know if he just lost it momentarily in the sun or if the wind caught it. He completely lost his balance and fell down. The ball landed behind him, and the Cubs won the game on that. That's how they won that game last year. Fast forward to last night. The Cubs and Pirates are playing a game at Wrigley Field, and there's a pop fly hit into shallow right field. The Cubs, the Pirates have kind of a shift play on, so the right fielder wasn't anywhere in the picture. It was the first baseman who had to try and go back and catch it. And I don't know how to say it any other way other than the first baseman running back kind of looked drunk trying to chase this fly ball down. He kind of circled around it, and he lost his balance, and he fell down. And so Chris Bryant got a double out of that play last night.
Nice.
So both of those videos have been making the rounds on social media.
Millionaires, you guys.
Yes.
Millionaires.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my social media nonsense for today.
I enjoyed watching that live for obvious reasons. So college football, rightfully, especially these days, a lot of the players don't have the best reputation. Lovie Smith aside, there's Baylor and there's a lot of other teams who've really done some nasty things. Florida State is also a team not necessarily known for great things. So it was nice to see this story. A lot of times football teams will go to local schools, do things like that. There's a player named Travis Rudolph. He went to visit a middle school earlier this week. And to just tell you that, there's this kid who has autism, I guess, and his mom wrote a note saying that he always sits by himself. She feels terrible. Sometimes I'll quote from her. Sometimes I'm grateful for his autism. That may sound terrible, but in some ways, I hope it shields him. He doesn't notice other people ignoring him or not getting invited to birthday parties, but she wonders about him, and she's always worried about him. He's a super sweet kid. A friend of mine sent this beautiful picture to me today when I saw it with the caption, Travis Rudolph is eating lunch with your son. I replied, who is that? He said, FSU football player. And then I had tears streaming my face. Travis Rudolph, a wide receiver at Florida State, and several FSU players. Blah, blah, blah. I'm not sure exactly what made this incredibly kind man share a lunch table with my son, but I'm happy to say that it will not soon be forgotten. So, very nice story, and it's nice that they're, not all college football players are terrible, horrible people. So we'll link to that, but that's a really nice story.
That's awesome.
And that's a great way to wrap up this week's edition of The Bandwagon.
Yes, we have crammed it all in for another episode, you guys. Good job. We would like to thank you for joining us on the bandwagon. Don't forget, there's plenty of room for everyone. Extra special thanks to our extra special guest today, University of Illinois soccer head coach Janet Rayfield. You're the best coach. You seriously are. The Bandwagon podcast is produced by John Steinbacher, Brian Moline, and Lisa Braltz. Scott Cameron is WILL's Director of News and Public Affairs. Jim Kelly designed our gorgeous logo and also suggested our theme song. That's Bandwagon, and it's by the band REM. Tireless tech support has been provided by Mike Bowman and Taylor Judd. They are superstars. You can find us on the web at will.illinois.edu/bandwagon. We have links. We have show notes. We have videos. You can also subscribe to this podcast and rate it in iTunes. Please do that rating thing. It really does help people discover us. You can follow us on Twitter at Bandwagon Podcast, but don't put any vowels in Bandwagon Podcast. It's all consonants all the time. You can get our most recent thoughts on stuff, and you can Twitter stalk us individually if you want to from there. We love questions, links, recommendations, etc. We are communicators, and we want to communicate with you. Also, programs like Bandwagon can be made thanks to, yes, I'm going to say it, listeners like you.
Thank you.
Visit willpledge.org to root for the home team, y'all. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with a brand new episode. Thanks again for listening. You guys are the best. Over and out.